This is what justice feels like. Gut-wrenching relief and exhaustion. It's not sweet or satisfying. It's necessary, important, even historic. Those are the words of Philonise Floyd, writing in the Irish Independent about the guilty verdict in the trial of former police officer Derek Chauvin in Minneapolis for the murder of George Floyd, the writer's brother. Philonise says that only with the passage of time will we know if the verdict is the start of something that will truly change America and the experience of black Americans. The Irish Times, in an editorial, comments that the conviction was hard won and depended on vivid eyewitness testimony, including visual recording and the evidence of fellow police officers. Other prosecutions will find it a high evidential bar to reach. And the paper notes that even in the last days of the trial, two more black youths died at police hands. The paper's lead stories bring happier news. A return to foreign sun holidays is likely before the end of the summer, according to the Irish Examiner, based on government hints. There is a similar message in The Independent, which reports that ministers believe that EU-wide digital green certificates could allow people in Ireland who are vaccinated to take holidays in other EU countries before the end of the summer. Vacation once again, says the Irish Sun. Let us play, says the Irish Daily Mirror headline, over a report that church services such as Mass and some sports are to get the green light from the government next month. The Irish Daily Mail calls it the slow return to freedom. A tentative easing of restrictions will see click and collect, hairdressers and religious services return next month, the paper says. As for next week, the Times reports that the Johnson & Johnson COVID-19 vaccine is expected to be in use by then. Delivery of the single-dose vaccine would, the paper says, be a significant boost to the inoculation programme. The Irish News reports that a file relating to two police officers involved in the controversial arrest at a commemoration in February has been sent to prosecutors. The memorial was for the five people killed when a UDA gunman burst into Sean Graham Bookmakers in Belfast in 1992. The man arrested, Mark Sykes, was wounded in the attack. The Independent marks Earth Day with a spread on pages 2 and 3. Caroline O'Doherty sets out five important environmental challenges which Ireland is facing and suggests five steps we could all take to protect the planet. She also reports that as the Climate Action Minister, Eamon Ryan, presented the climate bill in the Dáil, he was heckled repeatedly by rural independent TDs who accused him of trying to wipe out farming, destroy rural Ireland, and obscure the true cost of climate action.
Let's go straight to the news this morning that you heard in the bulletin. Gardaí issuing a child rescue alert for a missing 14-year-old girl from County Louth. Garda Superintendent Liam Geraghty, good morning to you.
Good morning, Áine.
Tell us about this alert.
Yes, Áine, last night on Garda Síochána initiated a Child Rescue Ireland alert for a 14-year-old girl, Svetlana Murphy. Svetlana was reported missing by her father on Monday the 19th when she was last seen leaving her home in Blackrock, County Louth at approximately 4 p.m. And our investigations over the last while have now given us to have serious concerns that there is an immediate and serious risk to the health or welfare of Svetlana. So we need to find Svetlana urgently if we can at all.
We've tweeted pictures of her on our social media account and it's also on the RTE website. Describe Svetlana to us, please, and the person she's with.
Yes, Svetlana is described as 5'1", slim build, brown hair and brown eyes. At the time she left her home, it's believed she was wearing navy tracksuit bottoms with a red and white stripe on the leg, a black zipped top and black runners. Now, we believe that Svetlana is in the company of an 18-year-old male, Nochus McElvekius. Nochus is described as being 6 foot, also slim build with dark brown hair and clean shaven. We believe he was wearing grey Snickers work trousers and a black Snickers top when last seen. However, they may have changed that clothing in the meantime. Now, it's our understanding that both Svetlana and Nochus are travelling together in a silver Hyundai Velostar car, registration number 132D13518. And our appeal this morning will be for any person who may see that car, 132D 13518, to contact on Garda Síochána Corner by dialing 999 immediately.
Have you any idea where they might have been or where they are headed?
We are aware that both Svetlana and Nohus were in Newry on the evening of Monday the 19th of April at approximately 7 p.m. And it is also aware that the car was observed in the greater Belfast area yesterday evening at about 5:30 p.m. So our appeal is not just obviously to your listeners maybe here in the Republic of Ireland, but also into Northern Ireland. So if anybody sees that car, a silver Hyundai Velostar, registration 132D 13518, they're asked to just dial 999 or 112 to either contact ourselves or our colleagues in the police service in Northern Ireland, who will pass any information on to us.
Have you been in contact with the PSNI?
Yes, we are in very, very close contact with the police service of Northern Ireland at this time, and we're getting their full support in relation to this matter.
And do you have any reason to believe that Svetlana might have left the island?
It's not our understanding at the moment. Our belief at the moment is that Svetlana and Nohus are still on the island of Ireland, and that is why the Child Rescue Ireland Alert has issued last night. We urgently need to speak to Svetlana. We need to know that she is safe and well, and we would urge either Svetlana or Nohus, if they are listening to this programme or if they hear these alerts going out today, to make contact themselves with us so that we can find out that Svetlana is safe and well and get her back to her family.
Obviously a very difficult time for the family.
It is a very difficult time for the family. We're liaising very, very carefully with them at the moment. We have a family liaison officer working with them.
All right. Thank you very much indeed for your time this morning. That's Garda Superintendent Liam Geraghty. And just a reminder of the registration of that silver Hyundai Velostar 132D 13518.
The National Immunisation Advisory Committee, or NIAC, will meet later today to discuss the use of the Johnson & Johnson COVID vaccine. It will also examine whether to recommend a longer interval between the first and second doses of the Pfizer vaccine. The European Medicines Agency has said that the overall benefits of the Johnson & Johnson vaccine outweigh any potential risks. In rare cases, it has been linked to blood clots. Meanwhile, the Taoiseach has taken to Twitter this morning to confirm that the vaccine portal will open to those aged between 60 and 64 tomorrow, starting with 64-year-olds. For more, let's talk to our science correspondent, George Lee. George, the Johnson & Johnson decision is a big one. Will you explain why?
It's a big one because we were due to get 605,000 doses of the single shot Johnson & Johnson vaccine. That means you don't have to go back for your second dose. Once you get injected once with this vaccine, that's it. You're done in terms of the protection that they're offering with this vaccine. We're due to get 605,000 by the end of June. So it was important, and it is important in terms of the rollout of the vaccine programme, where the government would like to have 80% of adults vaccinated in some form or other by the end of June. So if we can't use this particular vaccine, it does set us back a little bit in that target and in terms of the protection that people can have. And also, the fewer people who are vaccinated, it complicates opening up the economy. The thing about this particular one is that this vaccine is very similar in terms of how it's put together and what they call technology that's used behind it to the AstraZeneca vaccine. And the issues in relation to it about rare blood clots, which have been identified in America in around 8 cases out of about 7 million doses of it, are very similar. Very, very similar to what the European Medicines Agency was looking at in Europe about the rare blood clots which were associated with the AstraZeneca vaccine. But when the European Medicine Agency looked at the issue, they said in both cases they're safe to use insofar as the benefits far outweigh the risks, but that people should be made aware that there are these things to look out for in terms of the rare blood clots. The European Medicine Agency, when they made that recommendation about AstraZeneca less than 2 weeks ago, or about 2 weeks ago, the Irish NIAC, the National Immunisation Advisory Committee, took 3 meetings where they looked at, well, what are we going to say about this? And they decided, on the basis of what the European Medicines Agency said, not to give AstraZeneca to people under the age of 60. Now, if they're faced with the same decision today and they decide not to give Johnson & Johnson vaccine to those under the age of 16, it causes a bit of an issue because we're running out of people between the ages of 60 and 70, or will do in a relatively short period of time, to give the AstraZeneca to, and who would we be giving the Johnson & Johnson vaccine to. So there's hope among policymakers that maybe they won't be as restrictive on this time, but there will be some kind of conundrum for them, because if they don't allow it, or if they do allow it for under 60s, why would they not allow the AstraZeneca for under 60s? So it's a complicated decision.
As you say, a complicated decision. Will we get a decision today?
We can't be sure of that, because it took the three meetings the last time. The one thing which is probably in favour of maybe a quicker decision is that they're looking at pretty much the similar or same kind of circumstances that they would have considered before. So one would expect it shouldn't take them three meetings to figure this one out, and hopefully maybe they'd be able to get the matter resolved sooner than that. One of the things that they're toying with, and they will have to toy with, and it will be influenced by interdependent way about what they decide on who gets this particular vaccine, is the duration of the dosage on the Pfizer vaccine. Now, the reason why that's important is that at the moment there's a 4-week gap between a person who receives the first dose of the Pfizer vaccine and the second dose. The manufacturers had recommended you could have anywhere from a 3-week gap to a 6-week gap. In the UK, they're doing a 12-week gap. So it was always open to the decision makers here to decide to lengthen the gap between the first and second dose. In doing so, it would mean that the HSE and the vaccinators wouldn't have to hold back additional stock for a second vaccine so soon, so they'd be able to put everything out into the marketplace, everything out into people's arms, and that would speed up the vaccination. So one of the decisions today, and possibly maybe that one could be delayed, is whether or not they extend that gap to give them more flexibility with regard to rolling out the vaccination program if they do restrict the use of the Johnson & Johnson. So these are complicated decisions, and I suppose they take everything into account. It was very clear the last time that NIAC were saying that in terms of restricting the AstraZeneca vaccine to people not allowed to give it to people under the age of 60, that was influenced by the fact that they did have plenty of the Pfizer vaccine to vaccinate these people. But we're progressing with the vaccination programme, and the question is, what do we do next?
All right, George, thank you very much indeed for that.
The pandemic has changed the way we live our lives. Climate campaigners say the same level of action is needed, and urgently, if we're to stop global warming passing a tipping point in the next few decades. So today, President Biden is hosting a Global Earth Summit. We'll have more on that later. And Environment Minister Eamon Ryan, who'll be taking part and will join us after 8, he brought his Climate Action Bill before the Dáil yesterday to discuss all this. We have John Fitzgerald from the Climate Advisory Council. John Fitzgerald, good morning.
Good morning.
The Climate Action Bill, John, in a nutshell, what does it do?
It sets targets for Ireland for 2030 and 2050 on what we've got to do. And the target for 2030 is pretty tough. So we need pretty urgent action to change if we're to meet those targets. One of my concerns would be that we had a target enshrined in law for 2020 and we missed it. So that just setting the targets is not enough. You need action as well.
Carbon budgets are critical to this. How are they going to work and how are they going to be allocated?
The council will, under the legislation, the council will make a recommendation of how much we can emit between 2020 and 2025, and then how much between 2025 and 2030, and then a provisional budget for the following 5 years. So it will allocate the burden that how much we've got to change to each of the 5 year periods, rather than just having a 2030 target. So if we're going off tracks, we'll know earlier.
And different sectors, and of course the key sectors in terms of carbon emissions, are transport and agriculture. Different sectors will be allocated a certain amount they have to change. I'm looking at the Farmers Journal today. Farmers face cuts to herd sizes and fertiliser use. In other words, it won't just be targets, it'll be real change in all our lives.
The legislation won't bring about that real change. This legislation, it is further action which will make that happen, so that there will need to be major changes. Now, that those changes, when the council will recommend overall carbon budgets, and then the government will determine how those budgets are shared out across the different sectors.
One of the things you point to is housing. What's going wrong there and what should we be doing?
Well, I'm concerned that what's happening actually in forestry, and that one of the ways, major ways to reduce emissions is to suck carbon out of the air. And that's what trees do. That's what when you grow biomass crops do. At the moment, there's a massive holdup due to licensing systems. So the availability of timber is going down. In the housing area, at the moment, we build too few houses, but we tend to use concrete blocks a lot of concrete in building houses. If you shift to timber frame buildings, which is the norm in the US and much of Europe, you use timber, which actually holds carbon, and you use less cement, which emits a lot of carbon. And the hold-up forestry means that instead of producing more timber frame dwellings, which are faster to build than the traditional building, we're building fewer. So I think that this is one area where the government, it seems crazy to me that we have a licensing system. If a farmer wants to switch from growing barley to growing wheat, they don't need a license. But if they want to switch from growing barley or raising cattle to raising trees, they do need a license.
But there's an environmental impact of that has to be assessed has to be gone through there, surely.
Yes, it's identical that if you raise cattle, there is an environmental process that the runoff into the streams or rivers is controlled. And the way to deal with that is you have a regulatory system which works in agriculture. It's enforced by the EPA. And you just extend the regulatory system to cover forestry, so you can have regulations about biodiversity to deal with these issues. But the problem about the licensing system is anybody applying has got to prepare an application. You've then got to, it's got to be assessed, and the department are employing 30 people or more to assess them. Then it can be appealed, then it can end up in the courts. In a regulation, you know what you've got to do. If you don't do it, you end up in the courts. It's much simpler.
Today, Earth Day, Joe Biden bringing the US back into the Paris agreements and hosting this global Earth summit. I mean, if talk about the environment has certainly produced a lot of hot air, there was at the start of the pandemic a dip in global emissions, carbon emissions for a while, but they've gone right back up. So for all the talk, the world's still hotting up, isn't it?
It is, yeah. It's a real problem. Now, the transformation of the US is very important because they're a really big emitter, and they are a country with the technology to help develop the solutions. So Biden coming on board is important. The problem is, of course, that once again, the issue of actual action. He's got to get it through Congress. Now, there are certain things that he can do, like raising the emission standards for cars, which we've done in Europe and which Obama did very successfully in the US. So to drive the move to electric cars, that he will be able to do. But introducing things like a carbon tax, that you're into Congress, and I think he'll have major difficulties. So it's great that he's moving, the US is moving in the right direction, but we need action.
As I say, we'll have more on this with Minister Eamon Ryan later in the programme. For the moment, John Fitzgerald from the Climate Change Advisory Council. Thank you very much indeed for joining us on Morning Ireland.
Ireland is likely to resist any attempt to change existing treaties as part of European Union reforms. The position is outlined in an internal government memo seen by RTE News. Discussions on the future of the EU are due to start next month. Our Europe editor Tony Connolly has the story and he's on the line. Tony, tell us first of all, if you would, about these discussions on reform of the EU. What's due to happen?
Well, Rachel, there's going to be a big process now running into next year called the Conference on the Future of Europe. And this is looking at broad European reform. And it follows, if you like, a decade of really difficult crises for Europe. You know, we can look back to the financial crash. We had a big refugee migration crisis. We've had terrorism. And then, of course, Brexit and then the pandemic. And at each turn, you know, Europe has struggled to respond in a swift, if you like, or efficient way. And Emmanuel Macron came up with the idea back in 2017 that we have a rethink of how Europe works. So this plan was essentially sidelined by the pandemic, but it is now getting underway on the 9th of May. And it's going to look at what reform is needed at European level across a whole range of areas. But people will think of health policy in light of the pandemic, but also security, migration, economic integration, the whole digital question as well, what to do with digital giants. And of course, that will touch as well on the taxation issue. Mm-hmm. So I suppose that, you know, across the board, this will be an opportunity to look at how Europe can do things better or should do less or do more in particular areas.
Now, you've seen the memo outlining the Irish government position. What does it say?
Well, the memo is basically a guide to ministers as to the background of this conference, what Ireland's objectives and aspirations are. But I think the clear message is that Ireland does not want the conference to end up in wholesale rewriting of EU treaties. We perhaps know why, because that may require a referendum on Ireland, and governments tend to be allergic about European referendums given the experience of the past 20 years or so. But the government broadly supports the aims of the conference, and the memo sets out how the conference will work, what grassroots input will there be for the conference, and what structures will be used for that. So there's talk of building on the citizens' dialogues that were there in 2017 and 18. There will be a lot of grassroots input into the national position, and also the European Commission has set up its own digital platform, a multilingual platform for ordinary people and groups, local assemblies, parliaments, councils, as well as national parliaments to feed into this conference process. The problem is the conference itself, the structure is very unwieldy. You have a joint presidency made up of the presidents of the main institutions. You have an executive board made up of representatives from the institutions. And of course, the political groups in the European Parliament want to have an involvement as well. So the conference itself could be quite an unwieldy structure. But in any event, it's getting underway on the 9th of May.
Tony, thanks indeed for that. Tony Connolly there, our Europe editor.
RTE Radio 1 Sport with Kia. Going electric? Plug into the new Kia Ceed SW plug-in hybrid.
Kia. Movement that inspires.
And with the sport this morning, here's Des Cahill. Morning, Des.
Morning to you, Rachel, and great news for Irish gymnastics, because Emma Slevin from the Renmore Club in Galway has become the first Irish female gymnast to qualify for a European final. She scored 50.432 to reach Friday's senior all-around top 24 final. She was one of 109 gymnasts competing from 38 countries. So that's a great achievement. It'll be on RTÉ television on Friday. In golf, Leona Maguire carded a 2 under par 69 in the first round of the LA Open on the LPGA Tour. That's 5 shots behind the leader, Jessica Korda, who shot 64 for 7 under. Stephanie Meadow is 2 over par. Now, in soccer news, Manchester City edged closer to winning the English Premier League with a 2-1 win away to Aston Villa. City's win leaves them 11 points clear of Manchester United, with Pep Guardiola saying his side were so close to the title. But they had a scare when centre-half John Stones was sent off just before the break for a knee-high challenge on Jacob Ramsey. Villa, though, wasted the extra man advantage when Matty Cash was dismissed 11 minutes into the second half following 2 bookings in the space of 3 minutes. Villa had gone ahead after only 20 seconds with a goal from John McGinn. The impressive Phil Foden finished off a fine City team move to equalise before Rodri headed the winner. There was huge praise for Phil Foden after the game. This is what City captain Fernandinho had to say about the young midfielder.
I know him about 5 years now, so since he was a little boy, he comes to train with us, showed his quality, and was no doubt about that. And of course, he's really mature now. He's taking the action a little bit better, you know, he's chose better his actions. And of course, today he scored, and another game he was awesome as well. And I'm so pleased and so happy for him, because he's a nice guy, nice boy, and he deserves all the best in this life.
It's a nice tribute from your captain. Earlier, Spurs under caretaker boss 29-year-old Ryan Mason won 2-1 at home to Southampton. Son Heung-min's late penalty capped a Tottenham fight back after Danny Ings had put Southampton in front. Gareth Bale curled in a superb equaliser for Spurs, who keep alive their Champions League hopes now, and they get a timely boost before playing Manchester City in Sunday's League Cup final at Wembley. In Scotland, Rangers drew 1-1 at St Johnstone and Celtic drew 1-1 in Aberdeen. Japan is poised to declare a state of emergency in Tokyo and two other regions amid a surge in coronavirus cases just 3 months before the start of the Olympic Games. The arrival of a fourth wave in densely populated parts of Japan has caused alarm among medical experts and could further frustrate preparations for the Olympics, which are scheduled to open on July 23rd. Now, if the Games do go ahead, athletes will not be allowed to take a knee or protest against human rights abuses on the podium in Tokyo. It follows a poll of 3,000 athletes, and two-thirds of them said they support a ban remaining in place. Finally, for now, a reminder that racing this afternoon is at Kilbeggan, and the first race there is off at 2:45.
And we were talking a little earlier to Tony Connolly about European Union reform. We're going to turn next to an EU initiative aimed at clarifying which investments and economic activities are properly green and can contribute towards Europe's carbon goals. Mairead McGuinness, the European Commissioner for Financial Stability and Financial Services, joins us now on the line. Good morning.
Good morning.
What is this new scheme and who is it aimed at?
Well, yesterday we had a package of measures. As you rightly say, we have identified what we call the EU taxonomy, what it would mean to be sustainable for a whole range of sectors that account for 80% of our greenhouse gas emissions. So this is a first and it is groundbreaking. Linked with that, we also have published the details of how corporates, either listed or unlisted big companies, will be required to report on what they are doing around sustainability. And this is all about transparency so that investors will have information to make considered choices about where they want to invest their money, and that companies can also see from the taxonomy what they need to do to be sustainable in the medium to long term. And this is an issue that has been discussed globally now in the US and with other partners. So it moves, if you like, from fine words into action. And really, we don't have time to waste in this matter. This has been worked on over a number of years. I would have worked on it in the Parliament and now at Commission level, where we have to re-engineer the financial system. And in short, what we say, we have to green finance in order to finance green. So it's a very hard-edged, practical approach to changing how our economy operates in order to address the climate challenge. And this is our first, if you like, approach and our first target. We will be looking at other issues around biodiversity and indeed social issues. So I think for the, if you like, the asset managers and the fund managers who are looking for sustainable investment opportunities, this gives them clarity. It also gives companies clarity about what they need to report. Because at the moment, what companies are doing is reporting based on a number of different standards, and there's a lot of fragmentation.
Right,
so yesterday's package is designed to give clarity.
What if a company doesn't comply?
Well, look, there is no obligation on anyone to use this taxonomy. What there is an obligation on is large listed and unlisted companies to report their impacts on the climate in this case, and indeed how climate will impact on the company. And I think this is becoming more and more of an issue, even within the financial system, within banks and insurance companies. They need to, if you like, price the risk to their operations from climate. So in terms of what if a company doesn't comply, the truth is that for any companies that believe they have a long-term future in the European Union or indeed globally, they will want to comply with this because it will secure their future. If they need to draw finance from capital markets, and there is a huge demand for this because we reckon that 350 billion euros per year additional investment will be needed up to 2030, there's both a demand and there's a push from investors. The truth, though, and I think this is very sobering, is that when we look at how many of our economic activities would comply today with our taxonomy, it is in the single figures. So the enormity of the transition is painted, I think, in stark colours by that reality. And the biggest change will be to get capital markets to focus on those companies that are transitioning towards sustainability. And our work yesterday, which will continue with the Parliament and Member States, is to make sure the information is clear and usable and that everyone knows where we are heading. So the direction of travel is absolutely clear.
We were talking earlier about reform of the European Union and about the big issues facing the EU. And obviously one of those has in recent months been the vaccination programme. Now, Politico is reporting this morning, and I see that Reuters is now carrying a similar report, saying that the EU Commission is preparing to launch legal action against AstraZeneca. Can you confirm that?
I can't really make any comment on that because I wouldn't have the details and nor would it be appropriate for me to do that. But generally, in relation to vaccinations, we're all aware of the difficulties at the start of our process. I think what's encouraging is that across the member states, progress, real progress, has been made to roll out the vaccines, despite all of the delivery difficulties and indeed some of the questions about what age groups should get particular vaccines. And no more than in climate and in relation to public health, one of the things that strikes me is that we know that from a public health point of view, we needed more coordination at EU level. In fact, the president of the Commission was brave in making sure that happened because, truthfully, health is a member state competence. And it's the same with climate. You know, one member state dealing with the pandemic will not succeed. Equally, one member state dealing with climate will not succeed. So the idea of the Conference of Europe and the big challenges that face us, and we've faced challenges over decades, is that we don't flinch from them and we face up to them. And we engage with citizens through this conference on the future of Europe, where there will be big questions asked of Europe, what sort of future we want as European citizens, and how indeed can Irish voices shape that, because I think that's hugely important. I was struck by a figure in the European Movement poll of yesterday around climate, which we've just been discussing. And, you know, I'm aware that now 34% of those surveyed agree that Europe is doing enough to deal with the effects of climate change, which therefore means that more people disagree and we have to do more. And I think yesterday's package
34% is a pretty low figure. Just talking about Ireland's relationship with the EU, the Commission, as people will know, wrote to the government in Ireland urging less restrictive quarantine measures for EU citizens. Do you think that the current measures are excessive?
Well, look, I think the government made their decisions based on evidence and discussions at health level, and I'm not a health expert, so I just would bow to their expertise. When the Commission writes to a member state, it doesn't just write to one. It writes to any member state who is taking action that they just want information on. And I think in the case of Ireland, we perhaps had that third wave earlier, very difficult start to this year. Unfortunately, some of my colleagues in other member states are now facing into this. And I think what we're all trying to do is, you know, map a way out of this very difficult scenario without having had something in place. So in other words, we had no plan to deal with the pandemic. And I think the big lesson is that we should plan for the next one now and not be found wanting, whether that's about having production capacity for vaccines, having research and innovation, and having an emergency situation when these things arise. So look, I look forward, and I would encourage Irish colleagues and citizens to engage with the conference on the future of Europe, because every voice matters. And I think at a time of turbulence and change, whether it's pandemics and climate change and anxieties for our younger generation, it's important that we listen. And that's what this conference is absolutely about.
Mairead McGuinness, thank you for joining us this morning.
29 projects have secured funding under the third round of the government's Disruptive Technologies Innovation Fund. They'll receive a total of €95 million over the next 3 years. In just a few minutes, we'll speak to Dr. Imelda Lampkin from Enterprise Ireland, which administers the fund. But first, we can hear from one of the projects that has secured funding for a new technology designed to help cancer patients. A number of SMEs and researchers are involved, including Donal O'Shea, CEO of Decifex, who told me earlier about their plans.
In a simple sense, this technology provides patients who have received a diagnosis of breast or prostate cancer with an indication of risk of that disease becoming severe.
And is this technology the first of its kind, Donal?
This technology, you know, the use of artificial intelligence in terms of cancer biopsy evaluation is of growing interest globally, and Deciphex are at the forefront of deploying that technology commercially. And yes, we will certainly be one of the leading companies in this space in terms of providing technologies of this nature.
You've received €3 million in this latest funding round. How will you use it?
The funding will be used to prototype, validate and productionize the technologies that we plan to develop under this programme. And the output of this ultimately will be to develop a commercial assay that can be used routinely within the clinical setting to support the evaluation of patients.
Donal O'Shea, CEO of Deciphex there. We can speak now to Dr. Imelda Lampkin from Enterprise Ireland, which administers the fund. Imelda, Donal and his team are very much focused on technologies in the healthcare sector, but the projects approved for funding cover all sorts of areas.
Good morning, Jill. Yes, the projects announced by the Thánaiste this morning cover areas such as life sciences, medical devices and AI, but also manufacturing and environmental sustainability. So, for example, they include solutions for cancer and arthritis treatment, safety in factories and even subsea drilling. And as Donal said, they typically involve collaborations between small, medium enterprises, large companies, researchers, and it's that collaboration that brings real novelty to the projects.
Over 60 projects applied for funding. How were the final 29 selected, and was there tough competition?
Absolutely. The fund, which Enterprise Ireland runs on behalf of government, is competitive. And so the applications are reviewed by independent international experts, and only the highest scoring teams are called to interview. They really have to make a strong case for their disruptive technology. So it's technology that has the potential to alter the market. And then for the team that they're bringing together, they really need to show a cohesiveness. And for example, the role of the SME is key.
Is it likely that these investments will lead to further job creation over the next few months and years?
We definitely expect that. We're looking for economic impact. These are exciting companies. They range from university spin-outs to large multinationals with new technologies. So we hope that they put them into a strong position as the Irish and global economies rebound. So we really expect to see them creating high quality jobs and now and over the coming decades.
Okay, Dr. Imelda Lampkin from Enterprise Ireland, thanks for joining us.
And as we've been telling you this morning, Gardaí have issued a child rescue alert for a missing 14-year-old girl from County Louth, Svetlana Murphy. She disappeared from her home on Monday. She is 5'1" in height with a slim build. She has brown hair and brown eyes. She's in the company of an 18-year-old young man. The couple are believed to be travelling in a silver Hyundai Velostar car, registration 132D135 18. And earlier, Superintendent Liam Geraghty told us the Gardaí believe the two young people are still somewhere in Ireland.
Our belief at the moment is that Svetlana and Nohas are still on the island of Ireland, and that is why the Child Rescue Ireland alert has issued last night. We urgently need to speak to Svetlana. We need to know that she is safe and well, and we would urge either Svetlana or Nohas, if they are listening to this programme or if they hear these alerts going out today, to make contact themselves with us so that we can find out that Svetlana is safe and well and get her back to her family.
And that was Garda Superintendent Liam Geraghty talking to us earlier. Our Northeast correspondent Sinead Hussey has more. And Sinead, it bears repeating this information over and over again, because the Gardaí want as many people as possible to have an image of Svetlana and Nohas and to be able to help track them down. So tell us what this alert involves.
Yeah, so as you said, 14-year-old Svetlana Murphy has been missing since Monday after leaving her home on the Coast Road in Blackrock in County Louth. She was reported missing by her father, and in the early hours of this morning, a cry alert was launched because investigators believe there is an immediate or serious risk to Svetlana's health and welfare. Now, the Child Rescue Alert System was launched here in Ireland in May 2012, and it allows Gardaí to seek the assistance of the public where they believe a child may be at risk. So this is what we're seeing this morning. We're seeing Gardaí issue information about this child child a description of her, a description of who she's with, a description of where she may be in the last few days in order to make contact with her and to get her back to her family. Now, the description we've been given, she was wearing a black zip top, navy tracksuit bottoms with a red and white stripe and black runners. She's described as being 5'1" in height and of slim build with brown hair and brown eyes. Now, Gardaí say she's travelling with an 18-year-old man. His name is Noyes MacLevecchius, and they're understood to be travelling in a silver Hyundai Veloster car. The registration number on that car, 132D13518. He's described as 6 feet tall, of slim build, with dark brown hair and clean shaven, and he was wearing a dark grey Snickers work trousers and a black top. Now, Gardaí say they were seen in Newry at around 7 o'clock on Monday evening, and they say that the car was spotted in the greater Belfast area at around 5:30 yesterday evening, as you said, and as Garda Superintendent Liam Geraghty said, Gardaí believe they're still on the island of Ireland, that they're appealing to people both here in the Republic and in Northern Ireland, if they come across this car, if they see this car, to contact them. They are working with the PSNI. They're urging Svetlana to make contact, and they're asking anyone who has information to either ring 999 or 112, not to approach the car, not to approach the girl, but to ring 999 or 112.
Okay, and that's critical information that the Gardaí want any member of the public with information who may have a sighting or any other information to contact them directly.
Yeah, so anyone who may have seen anything today, we'll see on motorways, across social media, on every media outlet, both television and radio and online, there will be information. There is a picture of Svetlana. Gardaí are saying, you know, if you do have any information, any sightings, any sighting of the car, to make contact with 999 or 112, but not to approach either of the 18-year-old or the 14-year-old.
And that's the point of this alert system, is to get that information out to as many as possible so that people are aware and able to assist Gardaí in their search for tracking down Svetlana.
Yeah, the cry alert, you know, it enables Gardaí to get that information out to the public en masse. And what they're saying is, you know, they will be issuing updates throughout the morning and giving people information about what they're looking for. But at the moment, they've given a very detailed description of Svetlana. They've given a detailed description of the 18-year-old man, Noyes MacLevecchius, who she's with, and the car, the silver Hyundai Veloster car, the registration on that, 132D13518. And again, anyone with information should contact 999 or 112.
And that's our Northeast correspondent, Sinead Hussey. Any more information, we'll bring it to you throughout the programme and obviously throughout the day. Environment Minister Eamon Ryan is with us this morning. Good morning, Minister.
Good morning, Anne.
You've a busy day. You're taking part in President Biden's global summit later on, and you've brought your climate action bill before the Dáil. Just briefly, because we all remember Taoiseach Leo Varadkar, former Taoiseach Leo Varadkar, telling the European Parliament, admitting that Ireland was a climate laggard. You aim to make us a leader in the next 9 years. Do you really think that's doable? Because there's been a lot of talk about climate and a lot less delivery.
There has, but I think we are starting to show leadership, and I think we've shown it because there's consensus politically, and I think among our people on this, that we're tired of being laggards and we want to be leaders, and I think we will now. That's the key precondition you need. It's broad agreement, and we have that in the Oireachtas, and I think in local authorities and communities around this country. I think it was driven a lot by the student strikers that went out in recent years, reminding us of the scale and nature of the emergency, and I think that's compelling us. It will take several decades to achieve the objective of going carbon neutral, but that's the target we're setting ourselves. In the next decade, and this is what the bill sets out, it will be particularly dramatic because it's a 50% reduction in emissions we're looking to do. We're not alone in doing that. We expect the US...
And that's a huge lifestyle change right there.
For the better. And a new economy for the better. A new economy in how we run our energy system, our industries, our transport system, our agricultural system. But it is for the better. It's not going to work. If we do this as a hardship posting, as a shame, blame, kind of casting aspersions about other people, that won't work. This will work when we avail of new technological opportunities and new ways of doing things that protect nature. It has to address the biodiversity crisis as well as the climate crisis. That is distributed and balanced around the country. And it will have that characteristic because the energy supplies we're going to turn to exist right across the country, and we have an advantage in that compared to other countries. We will not be alone doing it. What we expect today at the conference is that President Joe Biden will commit the American economy to doing the same level of change. Yesterday, the European Union set out that as its ambition. The day before, the UK, something similar. So we will not be the only country doing this, but we will be up there among the leaders. I'm absolutely convinced of that. The bill we've introduced in the Dáil yesterday sets out the framework how our public service and all the agencies of the state will work within a plan that will be reviewed every year. Where we're falling behind in some section, we will have to implement the policies to catch up. It's very much connecting to what within the European Union we're committing to doing. I'm also attending a European Council meeting today where this will be set out. So this is happening. One of the things I'll be saying at Joe Biden summit today is that we are starting to show leadership already. One of the areas, Ireland in development aid has been really shown real leadership. We invest in climate adaptation and climate resilience, particularly in developing countries, the likes of Africa. That record is what I'm going to be talking about there today, that we need to apply that same thinking in terms of climate adaptation as well as mitigation. And we can do that here at home as well as in other countries.
Here at home, the headline in the Irish Farmers Journal: farmers face cuts to herd sizes and fertiliser use. You saw the opposition from the rural independents yesterday.
Yes, but going back to the, as I said, what I'll be speaking about today at this US conference is that actually the future of agriculture is in an agriculture which restores nature.
Will you accept amendments? Do you anticipate that there'll be attempts to delay the process of this bill through the Dáil, as for instance Shane Ross ran into with his drink driving legislation?
Much was said. What gives me confidence in our strength in this is that it is all party, and the Joint Oireachtas Committee on Climate Change spent a huge amount of time interviewing all the experts, holding all sort of internal sessions, working on what the best way of approaching this bill. They recommended 78 amendments. The government have accepted the vast majority of them. It's a much stronger bill on the back of that. So that means, I think, a lot of the work that would ordinarily be done at commission report stage has been done already. We have an urgency here time-wise. We need a new action plan in place for this summer.
So by when do you anticipate you'll be able to get this through the Oireachtas, given that you're getting criticism for going too far and for not going far enough?
We'll get it through within a number of weeks within the Dáil, and then we'll have to go through the Seanad. We need it in place so that by this June, July, we set the first five-year budget and the first climate action plan to implement it. And the reason we do that is because, so we start this year. 2021 is the first year of these three five-year plans that will be evolved on a rolling basis. So that's why there's a timeline urgency on it.
The carbon budgets, and that's going to involve, you know, lots of changes, reducing carbon emissions, and that involves, you know, for agriculture and for transport and also for people without a lot of income. The cost of fuel, the cost of energy. What about just transition? It's only mentioned in here once, is that right?
And it's key. And it's and we can reflect it already. We have reflected already in the budgets. We're already starting to increase. Last October's budget, we set aside $250 million to help people improve their homes. So that as a first step in terms of having a warmer, healthier home, which you, where you spend less money on fossil fuels.
You have to have a lot of money to spend before you're able to, you know, exploit government assistance in that regard.
But
isn't that the problem?
In that, what we're going to do first is focus on social housing to make sure they're upgraded, where the state will make the investment. But also invest in a warmer home scheme where those on low incomes, those at risk of fuel poverty, are the first to get the investment and get the home improvements. This can only work, as I said, if it is a just transition, and it's through those sort of measures that we make it happen.
John Fitzgerald was on the programme from the Climate Change Advisory Council. He was saying it's absolutely daft that farmers at this stage need to get licences for forestry when we are building, you know, different to the rest of the world. We're not building timber frame homes, which would be, you know, have much less impact on the environment. We're building them with concrete. And yet, at the same time, there are all these obstacles in the way, the red tape, the appeals, all the rest for farmers who want to grow trees. That's daft, isn't it? What are you doing about it?
He's right. We had a climate subcommittee on 3 weeks ago, and Minister Pippa Hackett, who's responsible for the forestry area, made a proposal that we would change the regulation so that if you take a lot for farmers, if, for example, if they have a river course beside them, a stream or a river, it makes huge sense for us to plant streams of forest along that. It improves the water quality. They act as a the roots act as a filtering system, so any runoff into the river is held back. It can and should and will be counted in terms of as a carbon store and as an improvement to wildlife.
But cutting the red tape, making it actually possible for the farmer to do what he's able to do with any other bit of his land, choose to move from one farm system to another, from one crop to another.
And that's why I'm saying it was agreed at a cabinet subcommittee that she would deliver those changes so we get a much more flexible system, both in the regulation and in supports for farmers to help them do that. It's not just in farming, it's not just in forestry. Across the board, our public service, what this bill does more than anything else, it says to the public service, we have to be fast now. We have to be flexible, we have to be collective, collaborate and act quickly. That's not always the first instinct in the public service, but in this instance we need to do it. If we make mistakes, we will reverse and then try a different way. But it's through that innovation, experimentation and actually using Ireland as an example of what can be done, I think we will show leadership and we will gain.
The NIAC meeting is going on this morning. The government is awaiting a decision from them on the Johnson & Johnson vaccine, and also there's a question about the dose intervals for the Pfizer vaccines and the Moderna vaccines. Taoiseach insisting again last night that 80%, 4 out of 5 adults vaccinated by the end of June, that target can still be met. Unless NIAC gives you longer dose intervals and Johnson & Johnson, you can't meet that target by the end of June, can you?
I think the Johnson & Johnson decision would be key within that. I think the dose intervals, to be honest, is more marginal because it makes a few weeks difference.
You might need it if you don't get Johnson & Johnson for younger people.
True, but the letter regarding AstraZeneca that NIAC sent, it could be interpreted in different ways. It wasn't ruling out that the use of that type of vaccine in a younger age cohort, how low down you'd go, you'd have to take health advice, obviously. I'm hopeful that there'd be similar flexibility in regard to the Johnson, because I think if we can get it in, for example, over 50s or 50s and over, that would in June, I think it's something like 600,000 doses that we'd be expecting roughly in that sort of time frame. And because it's a single shot dose, because it's that has a huge effect in terms of meeting those targets, but also protecting our people. I mean, the reason we would do that, or the reason we'd hopefully be able to do that, is it will actually save lives. It would lead to a much faster deployment of the vaccines, reduced risk of transmission and reduced illness because of that. So I'm hopeful that might be the outcome.
So you're awaiting that decision. The other issue as well, and you look across the newspapers today, and on the one hand we have the Taoiseach and the Taoiseach telling their parliamentary party meetings it's too soon for foreign holidays, and there are all kinds of headlines about foreign holidays there, and apparently ministers pushing for sun holidays. It's a bit like last November all over again, isn't it?
No, I think...
Will there be sun holidays this summer?
I hope there's a sun holiday in Ireland this summer. I hope abroad, the sun comes out in Ireland.
Guaranteed
this summer.
Sunshine we're talking about here, Minister.
I'll be meeting some of the airlines later on today, keeping in touch with them. And I think what they want, or what I would like to see as Transport Minister, is that we do not have another stop-start in regard to, you say, previous experience. We do not want to go into another lockdown. I don't believe we will. I think we've actually done a remarkably good job in the last few months as a country in a gradual management of what was a very high instance. We're working our way out. Restrictions will be lifted next week. We will allow the people who have been vaccinated to be able to not have to do the hotel mandatory quarantine system. That is coming. That will help. The further then kind of widening, opening up of travel, that will also come. The exact date, I think we have to hold back on, just for fear. What I fear is if we could see, let's say, in the next few weeks, in this critical period, we have another spike. You don't want to dash people's hopes again. So let's just take it step by step. We are on a gradual way out of this, of the worst of this lockdown system, and we will have a way of managing COVID. So there is international travel. People will be able to take holidays abroad. It is coming. But the exact timeline, I don't think we should raise false expectations yet with regard to that, but it will be coming within a number of months, I expect.
Was the European Commission satisfied with Ireland's answers on their questions about hotel quarantine?
Yeah, I think I'm absolutely confident we can defend everything we've done on the basis of public health, good public health advice.
Green Party leader, Environment Minister and Transport Minister Eamon Ryan, thank you very much indeed for joining us on Morning Ireland.
RTE Radio 1 Sport with Kia. Going electric? Plug into the new Kia Ceed SW plug-in hybrid.
Kia. Movement that inspires.
25 to 9, Des is back with the sports news, and it's not often you get to lead with gymnastics, is it, Des?
No, but it's a great news story in gymnastics, a huge boost for gymnastics in Ireland, because Emma Slevin from the Renmore Club in Galway has become the first Irish female gymnast to qualify for a European final. She scored 50.432 to reach tomorrow's senior all-around top 24 final. She was one of 109 gymnasts competing from 38 countries in Basel in Switzerland, and the final tomorrow will be broadcast live on RTE2. Meg Ryan was also in action yesterday in three of the four apparatus, and today it's the turn of Reese McLenahan, who's already secured his place for the Tokyo Games, and Adam Steele in the men's qualifying round. Now, speaking of the Olympics in Tokyo...
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah, the uncertainty, well, it changes week to week. Japan is now poised to declare a state of emergency in Tokyo and two other regions amid a surge in coronavirus cases. And as you know, it's just 3 months before the start of the Games. The arrival of a fourth wave in densely populated parts of Japan has caused alarm amongst medical experts. And so it could obviously further frustrate preparations for the Games, which are scheduled to open on July 23. Japan's numbers have been down low, but they're having problems with the rollout of the vaccine. Interestingly, if the Games do go ahead, athletes will not be allowed to take a knee or protest against human rights abuses on the podium in Tokyo. The International Olympic Committee did a survey of 3,000 competitors, and two-thirds of them have voted to support the policy of not allowing political protests at the Games. Moving on to golf, and Leona Maguire carded a 200-pound round of 69 in the opening LA Open at the LPGA Tour. That's five shots behind the leader, Jessica Corda, who shot 64 for 7 under par. Stephanie Meadow is 2 over. In soccer news, Manchester City edged closer to winning the English Premier League with a 2-1 win away to Aston Villa. City's win leaves them 11 points clear of Manchester United, with Pep Guardiola, their manager, saying his side are so close to the title. They had a scare, though, when centre-half John Stones was sent off just before the break for a knee-high challenge on Jacob Ramsey. But Villa wasted the one-man advantage when Matty Cash was dismissed 11 minutes into the second half following two bookings in the space of 3 minutes. Villa had gone ahead after only 20 seconds with a goal from John McGinn. The very impressive Phil Foden finished off a fine City team move to equalise before Rodri headed what proved to be the winner. Huge praise for Phil Foden after the game. This is what Pep Guardiola had to say about the young midfielder.
He's growing, this guy is growing. He's making steps every time, steps forward. So his influence in our game is massive right now. So scored a goal, provoked the two yellow cards, and then the final third always have the feeling he create, run a lot. He's so aggressive without the ball. Yeah, he's becoming a serious player.
He certainly is. Earlier, Spurs under caretaker boss 29-year-old Ryan Mason won 2-1 at home to Southampton. Son Heung-min's late penalty capped a Tottenham fight back after Danny Ings had put Southampton in front. Gareth Bale curled in a superb equaliser for Spurs. And that victory means they keep alive their Champions League hopes, and Spurs get a timely boost before playing Manchester City in Sunday's League Cup final at Wembley. A relieved Ryan Mason said Southampton had made it very difficult for his Tottenham side.
Listen, I thought they'd come out of the box. I thought they were excellent, to be fair. We found it difficult. They had set pieces. They built a bit of momentum. Hugo had to pull off a couple of excellent saves early on. Then they scored from a set piece. But I thought as the game went on, we gained control. In the second half, we had full control of the game. We were creating chances. And like I said, I really felt that there was only one team that was going to end up winning the game if one team did.
It did appear as a game of two halves to some extent in the end. What, Ryan, was the substance, if you will, of the half-time team talk?
Listen, it was just about giving the players the confidence. We planned, we prepared for everything. I know it was a short amount of time, but the biggest thing for me was the commitment, energy, the bravery to do good things and express ourselves and take risks at times. But most importantly, I felt the boys give absolutely everything and they fully deserved it.
There's one eye on Wembley, of course, but how important was tonight as far as the top four is concerned?
I think tonight was important for many reasons. Obviously, a change of manager. There's a lot that's gone on at club in the last 48 hours. And it was important to get back to winning ways. So, thankfully, we won. But not only we won, I thought the performance and the energy the guy showed was absolutely outstanding.
That's Ryan Mason. Now, in Scotland, Rangers drew 1-1 at St Johnstone and Celtic had a 1-1 draw in Aberdeen. And finally for now, racing action this afternoon is at Kilbeggan, where the first race is off at 2:45.
This is what justice feels like. Gut-wrenching relief and exhaustion. It's not sweet or satisfying. It's necessary, important, even historic. Those are the words of Philonies Floyd, writing in the Irish Independent about the guilty verdict in the trial of former police officer Derek Chauvin in Minneapolis for the murder of George Floyd, the writer's brother. Philonies says that only with the passage of time will we know if the verdict is the start of something that will truly change America and the experience of Black Americans. The Irish Times, in an editorial, comments that the conviction was hard won and depended on vivid eyewitness testimony, including visual recording and the evidence of fellow police officers. Other prosecutions will find it a high evidential bar to reach. And the paper notes that even in the last days of the trial, two more black youths died at police hands. Here, the Irish News reports that a file relating to two police officers involved in the controversial arrest at a commemoration in February has been sent to prosecutors. The memorial was for the five people killed when a UDA gunman burst into Sean Graham Bookmakers in Belfast in 1992. The man arrested in February, Mark Sykes, was wounded in the attack. A return to foreign sun holidays is likely before the end of the summer, according to the Irish Examiner, working on a government promise of good news on the horizon. There's a similar message in The Independent, which reports that ministers believe that EU-wide digital green certificates could allow people in Ireland who are vaccinated to take holidays in other EU countries before the end of the summer. Vacation once again, says the Irish Sun. Let us play, says the Irish Daily Mirror headline, over a report that church services such as Mass and some sports are to get the green light from the government next month. The Irish Daily Mail calls it the slow return to freedom. A tentative easing of restrictions will see click and collect, hairdressers and religious services return next month, the paper says. As for next week, the Times reports that the Johnson & Johnson COVID-19 vaccine is expected to be in use by then. Delivery of the single-dose vaccine would, the paper says, be a significant boost to the inoculation programme. The Independent marks Earth Day with a spread on pages 2 and 3. Caroline O'Doherty sets out what she calls five important environmental challenges which Ireland is facing and suggests five steps we could all take to protect the planet. She also reports that as the Climate Action Minister, Eamon Ryan, presented the climate bill in the Dáil yesterday, he was heckled repeatedly by rural independent TDs who accused him of trying to wipe out farming, destroy rural Ireland, and obscure the true cost of climate action. It was heckles and jeers, according to the Irish Farmers Journal. The paper reports that new climate targets in the draft agri-food strategy to 2030, broadly in line with the climate bill, would require a reduction of 400,000 cattle and a slashing of fertiliser use on farms. Meanwhile, in The Independent, it is reported that farming families own nearly €5 billion worth of shares in the biggest Irish publicly listed companies across all sectors, making them a linchpin of the market alongside US institutional investors.
The main news this morning, that a child rescue alert from the Garda Síochána for a missing 14-year-old girl from County Louth. The 14-year-old is called Svetlana Murphy. She's 5 foot 1 inch in height with a slim build. She has brown hair and brown eyes. When she went missing, Svetlana was wearing navy tracksuit bottoms with a red and white stripe on the leg, a zip top and black runners. Svetlana is in the company of Nohus Makulevicius. He's 18, 6 foot tall with a slim build. He has dark brown hair. He's clean shaven. He was wearing dark grey Snickers work trousers and a black Snickers top. He may also have been wearing a khaki green hoodie. Also critical here, both Svetlana and Nohus are travelling in a silver Hyundai Velostar car. The registration number 132D13518. And that car was last seen in the Greater Belfast area yesterday evening. Let's talk to our northeast correspondent, Sinead Hussey. And Gardaí stressing, Sinead, anyone with information, ring 999 or 112, not to approach those involved.
A child rescue alert was introduced in Ireland a number of years ago, and what it does is it enables Gardaí to seek the assistance of the public where they believe a child is an immediate risk or serious risk to the welfare of the child. So Gardaí and the PSNI, I suppose, appealing to people to contact them via the emergency numbers 999 and 112. As you said, Svetlana went missing on Monday, and as Gardaí Superintendent Liam Geraghty said, just after 7 o'clock, they were seen in Newry at around 7 o'clock on Monday evening, and the car they were travelling in was spotted in the Greater Belfast area yesterday evening around about 5:30. So Gardaí believe that the pair are still on the island of Ireland, and they're working closely now with the PSNI to trace the missing girl. He's urging them to make contact if they can, and also then if anyone has information, if anyone has seen the silver coloured Hyundai Veloster car, the registration number 132D13518, then they should contact 999 or 112.
And anyone travelling on the motorways this morning, they'll see that registration as well on the signs, as the signs above the motorways.
Yeah, so all over public motorways, you'll see the signs with the information, the cry alert. It will be emblazoned, you know, urging people that if they have any information on this car or on the description. Svetlana Murphy, as you'd said, is wearing a black zip top, navy tracksuit bottoms with a red and white stripe and black runners. And the teenager is described as being 5'1" in height and of slim build with brown hair and brown eyes. And she's in the company of Nojus Maclavekius, who's 18 years old. He's described as 6 feet tall, of slim build, with dark brown hair and clean shaven. And he was wearing a dark grey Snickers work trousers and a black top.
And RTE has pictures which have been issued by the Gardaí of the couple and of the car, which you can see on our social media feeds and on our website. And that is the alert that is coming from the Gardaí. Sinead, thank you for that for the moment. We're following this story, obviously, throughout the programme. And anyone with information to ring 999 or 112.
The Governor of the Central Bank, Gabriel McClough, has said many small Irish businesses will not survive the pandemic and will not be viable once state supports are removed. But he said it would be wrong to allow all companies currently making losses to fail. But what shape will the economy be in after the pandemic? That's a question Cian McCormack has been asking people whose lives have changed because of the COVID crisis.
We closed first in March of last year, and then we were allowed back open in July, and then we closed again in October, then we opened again in December, and then closed the end of December, and we've been closed since.
Richard Jacob has been on and off the pandemic unemployment payment for the past year. His wife and staff have been in the same situation.
So it's myself, my wife Mairead, and 4 staff as well.
His business, the Idaho Cafe in Cork City, depends on a steady footfall. And that's a concern for Richard.
I think this is going to be a great summer because I think there's a huge pent-up demand from people who were working and have saved. But I'd be very concerned about the autumn. I think footfall is kind of the huge elephant in the room, because the fact that there's such a move to online shopping and there's such a move to people working from home, that is going to have a huge impact on the dynamics of cities and the footfall and the way people come in.
The pandemic has been tough going for Richard, and he says it has resulted in 2 Irelands.
Psychologically, it's tough. There isn't a plan. I can't say, do you know, we're going to be going back on May the 17th. But I think we need to be very aware that not everyone was hurt in the same way financially. An awful lot of people had a little bit of inconvenience, or they've even done better financially because they're working from home. Whereas 400,000 people have been on a pandemic payment with no end in sight.
The predictions for the future are mixed. The central bank predicts up to 100,000 people will lose their jobs as a result of the pandemic. The ESRI says unemployment is unlikely to return to pre-pandemic levels until 2023 at the earliest. Professor Kieran McQuinn of the ESRI.
Where you will see the big bounce back clearly will be in the sectors of the economy which have been most impacted by the pandemic and by the public health restrictions. So clearly those sectors in tourism, in hospitality, retail, etc., these have all been very significantly impacted, in construction up until recently. So clearly as the economy opens up, you're going to see a big bounce back in those areas. As to whether they can go back to the same level they were at prior to the pandemic, again, that goes back to the whole scarring effect and whether firms in those sectors are in a healthy enough position to really go out and employ people and hire people and have the confidence to do so.
Dr. Frank Crowley, an economist at Cork University Business School at UCC, has a different view.
On the whole, I would be a bit more optimistic than the forecasts presented in the recent ESRI and central bank reports. The economy is likely to take off like a rocket. I think we can expect a euphoria associated with getting back to pre-COVID normality, which will spill over, I think, to all sectors. You know, this would be driven by pent-up savings, new startups, just a general multiplier effects that we will get from this increase in activity. So I think we will return to pre-COVID employment levels a little sooner than that predicted by the SRI and Central Bank.
There are positives and negatives on the horizon. There's anecdotal evidence of people moving to rural areas to live and to work remotely. Again, Professor Kieran McQuinn.
Given the very high cost of housing, particularly in urban areas such as Dublin, it wouldn't be at all a surprise to see people move to non-urban areas where accommodation is substantially cheaper.
This has been experienced firsthand by Raideen O'Connor.
I moved from Dublin. We took the decision very early on. We're saving quite a lot. We were lucky that we sold our house in Dublin.
Raideen moved back to County Kerry to work as a manager at the Research, Development and Innovation Hub, RDI, in Killorglin in the past year.
I think the biggest change, being honest, Cian, is the childcare. You know, I was paying $2,200 a month. It's been a game changer for a lot of people. Like, I know friends from my class going to school that I would have lost touch with who moved back to the kingdom that would have worked in Google or would have worked in city councils. That's a huge game changer for the regions.
There are benefits for rural communities like Killorglin, the RDI Hub's CEO Liam Cronin.
Pre-COVID, if you decided to live in the west of Ireland or somewhere like Kerry, the assumption you had to make a career sacrifice. But that's not the case in the post-COVID world, where you'll be able to work from anywhere in any role. It definitely helps create a thriving local economy.
And that report was from Cian McCormack.
So continuing with that theme on Earth Day, upgrading home insulation is a central part of the government's climate action plan. Irish homes make up a quarter of overall energy use and they generate 10% of our greenhouse gas emissions. Now in 2017, that amounted to 6 million tonnes of greenhouse gases. The plan is to reduce those domestic emissions from 6 million to less than 4 million tonnes by 2030. And that involves retrofitting about 500,000 homes. How close are we to that goal? Coleman O'Sullivan reports.
A team installs heat pumps in homes off St James's Avenue in Dublin's Liberties. Resident Jacqueline McAdam was one of the first to get one. She's looking forward to a more comfortable home next winter.
Oh, hopefully it'll be great because we have to put curtains up on the back of the doors and towels at the windows, so hopefully we won't have any of that anymore. With the new windows and doors going in, the new heating system, it has to be an advantage, a good advantage.
Kieran Carmody of Kingdom Installation is managing the project. He says doing retrofits in groups of homes is easier and more cost efficient.
There's 46 homes in a cluster here. So for scale of economies, you know, it's ideal. It's an ideal situation here because you get excellent value for money. The works are carried out, much faster.
The homes here are provided by Cooperative Housing Ireland. It is paying for 40% of the cost of the retrofit. Policy and Communications Manager Owen Carroll says it's a good investment.
We know from our member survey conducted last December that heating is a real issue, and we know that fuel poverty is a real issue. So if we can conduct these large-scale upgrading works, we know that over the next 20, 30 years that we've essentially future-proofed in terms of management or specifically maintenance costs. So that's a real benefit for us.
Half of the cost is covered by a grant from the Sustainable Energy Authority of Ireland. Declan Mealy, Head of Department for Transport and Communities, says group schemes are becoming more popular because they make sense.
We now have over 500 communities actively working together and working in terms of bringing projects together, working through project coordinators. So we've seen a real uptake on that, and there's been over 300 million invested through our communities programme.
But what about individual homeowners? The target of 500,000 homes in 10 years is very ambitious. Dr. Paul Dean, a research fellow at the Environmental Research Institute at UCC, says more will have to be done if that target is going to be met.
A lot of the policies that we have in place are good, but they need to be scaled up massively. There was a nice announcement today on an apprenticeship scheme from the minister, but what's lacking at the moment is a clear pathway for the financial investment that house owners will need. You know, so I think what we'll have to do is put a lot of money on the table, particularly 100% grant funding for homeowners who can't afford this.
And while Kieran Carmody is optimistic about the future for retrofitting, he agrees there are challenges.
What we've seen is, from materials, I suppose shortage of materials, delays in materials coming from, you know, outside of Ireland and Europe, obviously with the pandemic. We see price hikes across the board. You're talking about 15-20% price hikes on materials across the board.
For the SEAI, Declan Mealy says their plan for retrofitting is progressing as planned.
Last year it was 4,000 homes, this year it's 13,000 homes, next year 30,000. Big step up to around 50,000 a year. But that is achievable. It's a whole of government plan, so everybody is working on that together.
Kieran Carmody says one way to get there is to get every home in an area, no matter who owns it, retrofitted together.
It's about inclusivity and including all the homes. And we know of housing associations where there are council houses and private houses within the estates, and that they have been brought on board as well.
Coleman O'Sullivan reporting there.
In the United States, protests were held in North Carolina and Ohio last night following two separate shootings that saw black people killed by police. In North Carolina, a sheriff's deputy fatally shot a man while serving a search warrant. Meanwhile, in Columbus, Ohio, demonstrators gathered again last night to protest over the killing of 16-year-old Micaiah Bryant. The deaths came as the U.S. Justice Department announced an investigation into the Minneapolis Police Department following this week's guilty verdict in the Derek Chauvin trial. Our Washington correspondent Brian O'Donovan has been following developments.
In Elizabeth City, North Carolina, a sheriff's deputy yesterday shot and killed African-American man Andrew Brown Jr. while he was serving him with a search warrant. Now, witnesses say the man was shot while trying to drive away in his car, and the deputies fired multiple times at the vehicle. The officer involved has been placed on leave pending a review of the case by the State Bureau of Investigation. Now, protests were held in North Carolina last night calling for accountability and calling for the release of body camera footage. There were also further protests last night in the city of Columbus, Ohio, where 16-year-old African-American girl Micaiah Bryant was shot by a police officer during an attempted stabbing incident. Now, this is the shooting that took place just as that Derek Chauvin verdict was being delivered earlier this week. Authorities say that based on police video footage, it appears that the officer in this case was acting to protect another young person, and an investigation is underway. But that hasn't stopped people coming out into the streets demanding justice for Micaiah Bryant. All of this happening, Rachel, today, the day that the funeral will take place of another African-American man who died at the hands of police, Dante Wright. He was shot 2 weeks ago in a Minneapolis suburb by a police officer who claimed she mistakenly used her gun instead of her taser.
Meanwhile, there's this continuing response to the result of the Derek Chauvin trial. There's to be an investigation into the Minneapolis Police Department. How's that likely to work, and is it likely to bring about change?
Well, yesterday, Rachel, Merrick Garland, the US Attorney General, he decided to wait until after the verdict in the Chauvin case to announce this investigation so as not to influence the jury. He said that nothing could fill the void the loved ones of George Floyd have felt since his death, and that the verdict in the trial did not address potentially systemic policing issues in Minneapolis. So this investigation will look at policing practices in the city. And the way it works is that if the Department of Justice finds a problem, it can actually take a lawsuit. It can take a civil lawsuit against the police department. This would then result in the department entering into a court-agreed settlement that would see it bringing in changes and improvements. Now, these kinds of investigations, these kinds of settlements have been done in the past in other cities with other police departments. Analysts say that they can result in improvements in equipment and training, but they produce only mixed results when it comes to the use of force. The Attorney General Merrick Garland yesterday outlined the specific areas within the Minneapolis Police Department that his investigation will focus on.
The investigation I am announcing today will assess whether the Minneapolis Police Department engages in a pattern or practice of using excessive force, including during protests. The investigation will also assess whether the MPD engages in discriminatory conduct and whether its treatment of those with behavioral health disabilities is unlawful.
Merrick Garland separately, Brian, as we've been hearing on the programme today, the US President Joe Biden is going to switch his focus to climate change. He's hosting a virtual summit of world leaders. What's on the agenda?
Well, Rachel, as we know, the previous US President Donald Trump pulled America out of the Paris Climate Accord. His successor, Joe Biden, reversed that decision. And I think what we'll see today is him using this two-day virtual summit as an opportunity to very much tell the world that the US is back, once again a global leader when it comes to tackling climate change. Joe Biden is also expected to announce an ambitious new US target for the cutting of carbon emissions. An exact number hasn't yet been confirmed by the White House, but it is reported that it will be a 50% cut by 2030. That's a doubling of the country's previous commitments. Now, this is a big summit. Leaders from around 40 countries taking part, including China and Russia. Ireland will be represented at the summit. The Minister for the Environment, Eamon Ryan, will be taking part. He'll be involved in a discussion on climate adaptation and resilience, which will be chaired by the US Agriculture Secretary.
And that was Brian O'Donovan.